How do you think design thinking can help us to kind of create a world that's kind of more mindful or more compassionate? And how do you think AI could potentially help support that?
Can it? Well, huge questions.
Yeah. Hello and welcome to Mindful Conversations. My name is Shamash.
I'm Calvin.
And we are with this very special guest, Professor Lucy Kimball.
That's right. Hello.
Hello. Welcome. And you're a friend of Calvin, so maybe you could start by sharing a little bit about how you got to know each other. That's quite interesting.
The real way.
We met on a two-day NVC course, which was online in, I think, the first year of the pandemic.
NVC yeah. meaning?
Non-violent communication, okay. Which is an approach to, you could say, personal development, and understanding how you communicate with people. And then we had a practice group of two of us for a year. So we met on a Sunday morning. Once a month, and created a space for ourselves, for each other, using NVC principles, and tried out some of the techniques, which is one of the principles, is you practice it.
Interesting. Yeah. Cool.
So we didn't actually meet in person till, I don't know.
A year after that,
yeah.
Okay. And we're here on Stable Street in King's Cross. That's why you're hearing these kind of background sounds and lots of building works. And that's because of your university that you work at is just around the corner from here.
Yeah, so Central St Martin's is just behind us on Granary Square. It's our building is called the Granary Building, and it was one of the first buildings to become open and start functioning. The other, actually one before that, was probably the Guardian Building on York Way. So this is the biggest building site in Europe and has been for about a decade.
Wow.
And as we look around us now, there's just a phenomenal number of quite large buildings, mostly with fancy flats.
Yes.
And it's a destination now, with a load of shops there in that, just behind where we're sitting. And this is although I appreciate the fact that it's bringing new life to what was a, you know, dead bit of London, and perhaps you used to come clubbing here in the 80s.
I think my mother used to work there.
It used to be quite a dangerous place around here, actually.
Yeah, so now it's, it's a huge project, but it's also, I would say, quite exclusionary. It looks like public space, and it's not, right? So the rest of London, as you know, there are many, many people who are homeless or begging. You will never see that here. I think they're just tidied away. So it's a very curated space. The landowner sort of has security guards who wear little red t-shirts, and it's all very curated, like having that everyman pop-up cinema by the canal. Pop-up food stalls, all sorts of things. So it's great to visit, but if you are not affluent enough, and you may live just 5 minutes walk away, it may feel that it's not for you. So I think it throws up some problems, and is quite, I have some ambivalence about working here. On the other hand, it's also extremely convenient.
Yeah, we have spent some time here doing concerts or having a drink, and it's a beautiful space. So what do you do in your everyday life?
So I'm Professor of Contemporary Design Practices at Central St Martin's. That is one of the constituent colleges of University of the Arts London, which is one of the largest combined art and design schools probably in the world, made up of six of London's historic art and design colleges. Other design schools often are a bit of a, it's within a bigger university, but we're a monotechnic. We only have art, design, fashion, media, architecture, communication, performance, etc. So that's unusual to have a concentration of all those creative disciplines. So it's, but spread across different sites. So this is one of the sites.
Oh, wow. And would you say you specialise in design thinking?
I would say I specialise in design thinking, service design, and the application of design principles and practices to social and public policy problems. So I I sort of research it, I study it, and I just study some of those developments. I don't teach much at the moment, but I do have PhD students who are doing really interesting and innovative applications of the creative process to public policy problems, for example.
Very cool. And I know this is, might be a challenge for you because if you're a professor, you talk about research a lot, but to simplify, what is design thinking?
Well, this is, we could get onto our second topic, AI. So if you put that into ChatGPT, you would probably get a definition that says it's an approach to creating new products or services, but possibly also strategies or policies, which has an emphasis on how people experience things. So sometimes the word human-centered is used. So how someone experiences through iterative cycles of learning and experimentation that we would call prototyping in design.
Yeah.
Strong emphasis on visualization and materializing. So making mock-ups, drawing, animation, you know, whatever media, but making it present so it's not just in words or spreadsheets. Those are probably the main principles, and also synthesizing lots of different understanding and knowledge. So those are the main kind of principles of design thinking, and you can find that done by consultancies, but you can also find it in now central government, public services, startups. It's a sort of it's a capability, you could say. So when you do learn product design, if you did a bachelor's in product design, you would learn that. You might not call it design thinking, you're just learning how to do product design or graphic design, but the design thinking terminology is more saying, well, maybe we can abstract those methods or that approach and apply it to an organizational challenge or a social issue or a public policy problem.
Okay, wow. And you know, yes, we are going to be talking about AI, and like, you know, it's quite interesting that we're in King's Cross and we were discussing earlier this huge building that's been growing for the last few years, Google, which has obviously been spending a lot of money on AI, and perhaps that's why it's partly why it's been as successful as it is. But what do you think, just initially, like this whole growth in AI, what's your feeling about it?
So I'm not an expert in that. Yeah. I'm trying to understand, I think like many of us, like the world is changing rather rapidly, both technology and lots of different technologies, you know, as well as cryptocurrencies, security, blockchain, the cloud, Internet of Things, augmented reality. There's a whole load of technological things, sort of which automation and AI is one part. And I'm trying to make sense of it myself. I'm not directly involved in any research on that at the moment. Academic research, and I like many people, dabble with ChatGPT just to try and understand but that's only one aspect of it around creativity and idea generation, and I try and follow some of the other people who are much more knowledgeable to understand what the implications are. But I think it's something slightly concerning, but also what I hear from some of the things I read or listen to is it has potential huge. But there's huge potential probably, and given the massive scale around challenges around healthcare, climate and so on, you know, sources of innovation, transformation, maybe some of those things can help.
Yeah.
But I think there's quite a lot of ethical issues.
Yeah, a lot of unknowns, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one thing Shamash and I have been talking about a lot, as we mentioned when we had that delicious cake a minute ago, was, you know, we were asking people the question, what do you think it means to be human? Because you talk about human-centered design, you know, we talk a lot about human-centered. Is that more important now than ever, being human-centered? And what does that even mean in the context of your work?
Yeah, great question. To be human now, if I just take my life, right, and somebody who lives on the other side of the world, who's in a small village that hasn't got the resources that I have access to be human, their version of being human might be quite different. So for me to be human at this point in time, I'm regularly using technology routinely without noticing it. I'm surrounded by technological infrastructures that create, you know, you could say opportunities and intensify some outcomes, including inequalities, but also produce opportunities. So to be human now is already implicated in technology, I think.
Yeah.
And even if you're somebody living somewhere in a, you know, a remote place that's a village in a, in an extremely poor country far from the capital, for example, you personally may not have access to a mobile phone and those technologies, but someone you connect with probably does.
And how do you think design thinking can help us to kind of create a world that's kind of more mindful or more compassionate? And how do you think AI could potentially help support that?
Can it?
Can it? Well, huge questions. Yeah. So first of all, your question around can design thinking help with some of these challenges? So this is an area that I've been following for sort of 10 or 15 years. So the use of design, meaning sort of art school creative design, which it happens alongside engineering design, for example, and architecture, which is sort of set up or organized a bit differently. There's a lot of work with people using those principles I mentioned, those practices tied to helping, it's built into bits of the NHS already, for example. Social entrepreneurs have been using these approaches to try and sort of quickly get going with whatever their social enterprise is to try and address a social issue. And now, for the last decade or so, central government, including here in the UK, government policy making teams are also using some of those approaches alongside other forms of other methods and sources of data and insight and collaboration to generate policies. So it's already being used in lots of different ways. But I can tell you it's sort of widely used. So sometimes that's called social design.
Yeah.
There are people who specialize more on the environmental side or more on well-being and so on. But basically, you know, if you're designing something, whether it's a product or a service or a vaccine or a building or a new part of London, a landscape, you are designing something. And the premise of design thinking is that you might do that better if you do it through those principles I mentioned earlier, through experimentation, through co-design, through collaboration.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say it's the only approach, but it's those things are also relatively unspecific, so that people could be doing it without thinking they're doing those things.
Yeah.
Unconsciously designing.
Yeah.
So design not thinking.
I'm thinking, but I was running a workshop yesterday in a university, helping them. They're designing basically a university process. So you might think of that as quite bureaucratic. And so there was, I don't know how many people, we had maybe 20 people involved. One of the things I'd asked them to do is draw a picture. And these are people, you know, very skilled professionals. And I said, look, just go with this. We're only going to spend 5 minutes on this exercise, but just draw, and then we repeated it 5 times, draw a potential solution to the thing we're talking about. And, you know, may not be in your comfort zone, just go with it. And one of them said afterwards, yes, I would never have done that. And I could see that it engaged, this is a very, you know, very senior person, very experienced person, it engaged a different part of my brain. So if you're a design creative, you know, performance artist, video maker, poet, it's normal for you to sketch, to draw, to sort of mess around, to meander. You know this, Calvin, you've written a novel. So to try things out. But if you're not from that sort of those practices, you might think, well, I wouldn't do that, it's not relevant. So I think the trying things out in a different medium, trying and just going with it, can produce serendipity and creativity, which also links to the topic we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Well, actually, creativity, that magic word, back again.
Yeah.
What? How does AI, in your mind, as somebody who's an artist, because, you know, we walked past an art gallery the other day, and Lucy was like, she's like, look at that. And I was like, you're an artist. She was like, of course I'm an artist. I'm an artist first. So, you know, what, as you're talking about design, art, creativity, how does, in your mind and sort of worldview, does AI influence, change that? Do you see that as a huge opportunity? Or is it a threat?
Both. There we are, done. again, I'm not an expert, okay? So I'm just sharing with you my current state of understanding absorbed from the stuff around me and messing around a bit. But a bit like the mobile phone, right? The mobile phone is not just the device, the thing you touch and, you know, carry with you all the time now. It's tied to infrastructures, it's tied to business models, it's tied to extraction of minerals in, you know, West Africa or Australia for batteries. It's tied to all sorts of things, right? So if you think of the technology as sort of spread across time and space and connected to lots of other different things, like any other thing, it could have positives and it can also reproduce structures that are negative, structures that are damaging, structures that are exclusionary and have negative consequences for others and indeed yourself. So I think it's too early to say. There's some amazing things about, you know, the internet, but there's dangers that come with it. My daughter, you know, a teenager, Calvin and I have discussed teenagers quite a few times. You know, her generation, glued to the devices, playing a game. She was holding up the device the other day going, look at this, it's really beautiful, it's of wood. And I was like, I went to an actual wood this morning. Right? You could have come with me for a walk on Hampstead Heath. And we could have gone through some beautiful woods together. And I appreciate that you're seeing beauty in this on-screen wood that you're going through that someone's designed. And it's not either or, right? It's just that some of the teenagers and the life stage that they're at, they're absorbed, they find it absorbing and containing to be in a particular world. Whereas I'm an older, much older generation. Given a choice, I'd rather go and walk in a wood and experience things in an embodied way, and you know, I think some of the intensifications are worrying, both for mental health, for community. Again, none of this is new, but it's sort of like when you see it close up with a member of your family or a friendship group.
Yeah.
And also our students. You know, our students are younger generation, and then also they're the generation that, you know, experienced a lot of their university education in their bedroom, and without the chance for, you know, art education is about doing things with your hands and your ears and your nose and your body and learning woodwork or learning painting or learning how to make things with your hands and being in a group, exploring things, and digital versions of that. And there's been a huge probably knock-on negative effect from the pandemic and an intensification of the digital channels as a way of developing your creativity.
And you know, that's making me think about the link with AI, because let's say your daughter, she's using maybe social media, you know, and social media is driven by these AI algorithms, yeah, right, to try and make it more and more addictive. And so you can almost say it's not even her fault or people's fault at that age, because if the AI is so powerful, it can work out exactly the right thing to give you that kick. So how can you think design thinking can be used to help kind of manage that? Is there any way that you could think about applying policies for corporate organizations, because they're just interested in maximizing their profits ultimately? What can be done? What do you think can be done to help kind of rein that in? Otherwise, this AI, which is just going to potentially get more and more powerful, we could end up spending even more time on our screens and really not even interacting with the real world at all.
Yeah,
so I think you're asking, can these design thinking type principles be applied to sort of minimize the harms associated with AI? And actually, there are some people working in that way at the moment. So there's a project led by some social scientists called Shaping AI. They're operating in, I think, four countries, UK, Canada, Germany, and the US maybe. But some of the academics are in France. Anyway, it's an international collaboration where they're trying to understand what are the risks of AI. And that has got some design people within it who are using some of these methods, creative, co-design, participatory methods to open up the conversation. So that's an example where they're actually looking at trying to understand how it is at the moment, how it might be differently, and involve people in that. So it's not just a survey, you know, what do you think Fillet Click here about AI or even an interview, but actually sort of do some making and dialogue about what these futures implications might be. So that's an example in the research space. I'm sort of hoping, I don't know if it's the case though, that some of the people who work in that large Google building just over there by King's Cross, not the new one that's not built yet, you know, there's lots of designers in those teams. You know, you'd hope that some of them are empowered to work with the technologists. That's a hope though.
Yeah, not sure.
And there, but I do think creatives, there's an area called speculative design or speculative research where people use creative methods and they might make future objects or they might make future scenarios or films, little videos, or or even performances or installations to throw up some of the challenges and the dilemmas in a way that people can grasp. So I think design people are responding in a range of ways because design isn't just one thing. And so and certainly I know colleagues who are teaching at Central St Martins and internationally are dealing with some of these questions in their professional practice or working with students to address them.
One question for you about, because your work is intersecting in policy, you have interest in that area, and that kind of differs quite a lot from, say, a production factory, let's say, who wants to use design thinking to churn out loads of products or whatever. Do you think that design thinking has a role to play in enriching the ordinary experience of human life, independent of profit making, and whether AI is more of a help or hindrance in that scenario?
Ignorant as I am, I was listening to a podcast the other day with the founder of DeepMind, which is also down the road in King's Cross. Not even road, down that path there.
We're not even real.
So this is the Ezra Klein Show, which is a New York Times podcast, and I listen to it occasionally, and it was with that guy who's from the UK. And he was talking about how he got interested in it, AI or technology, like through gameplay. And when he set up DeepMind, it was about using, basically to improve gaming and develop.
Yeah.
Again, this is not my field, right? So I'm summarizing a podcast that I listened to last week with someone who I just thought, this is the kind of podcast I'll at least listen to twice to make sure I've understood it. But he was so interesting because they then got him to talk about, Ezra Klein got him to talk about how he set up the company. And then they did that, that game, that Asian game Go, that basically it basically developed it through using machine learning so that it actually got to the point where it could beat the best players.
Yes.
So that was AlphaGo. And then they took on a problem in science using some of the stuff they'd learned, and that's called AlphaFold, which was about the folding of proteins, which is a research problem. And again, I'm merely paraphrasing what I understood from that.
Yeah.
Not only am I not an AI person, I'm not a scientist, although he was so eloquent and clear. Basically saying, you know, here's this problem in science, right? Massive scale, and normally it would take a PhD, you know, 3-4 years to understand one bit of folding for one protein, and we have however many proteins we have in our bodies. And so there's a massive set of problems, and those are then the causes of disease. And also they have implications for medicines, because when you design a medicine, they need to latch onto the protein, so you need to understand the shape. So it's almost design in the sense of the creation of objects, right? So they needed to understand the folding of proteins.
Yeah.
And as I understood it, they then applied everything they'd learned from the AlphaGo and the success they had in actually developing a deep learning, a machine learning process to actually achieve a successful outcome, to then do something in that space with the scientists, which actually produced an advance. And that got on to the question of creativity, that they could do something both at the scale, the number of things they could do, just with the vast amount of data set, the vast amount of data they could do, but it was meaningful for the scientists and allowed the scientists. So he saw that as a tool, the way he presented it, and they released all that so that scientists could use it. So that's an example where they're using it, you know, for human good.
Yeah.
I don't know about the intellectual property arrangements or about the, you know, whether there's a little thing inside it so that it, you know, they make profit. I don't know. I didn't follow that up. But you can see that that's a really visionary use of something, both to demonstrate the efficaciousness of AI in that specific context, and something incredibly creative as well as rigorous. And so if it can do that in that context, I imagine they could then potentially do it in other very complex problems. But what I would say that is different to a creative process of the type that I'm more familiar with is that that's relatively well defined. Like, again, I've never played the game Go, and I also don't play chess, where obviously some of this has happened in a previous generation, right? It's that it's relatively well, the, you know, when you're playing chess, you are moving things, like the number of moves is, you know, a very large number, but you're basically moving things on a board. It's relative, you know, it's a 2x2 matrix on a board. It's 2D. And then the protein folding thing, probably there's a phenomenal number of variations. But when you're creating, you know, a sculpture, it could be anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are the dimensions, right? Right. So there's something about what it is to be human and the meaning of a sculpture, or the meaning of a song, the meaning of a story, the meaning of, and these are cultural things, and they...
And that's what artists really care about, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, these guys are Hollywood. Half of them are striking because they're worried about their jobs.
Yeah.
But the other half are actually striking because they think the art part of the creativity that goes into the production cannot be replicated by AI. And it almost takes the soul. They don't say this themselves, but I imagine that's what they mean. I have a two-part question, but I thought I could ask you...
We're going to need some more cake. Thought,
but the two-part question is this. Hearing a lot of the potential that AI has to transform society, either good or bad, first part of the question is, how would you personally want to use it as a creative and artistic person, or not use it?
Interesting.
And the other part is, as a professor, how do you see it changing education?
Yeah. So, as a creative person, I now... I did think, for example, as a little test, to even put in a query into ChatGPT ahead of this today, talking to both of you, just to see what it said. Not to give ideas, but just to see. And there are questions around accuracy and the data set it's using and so on. But just, it's like it then becomes a partner or something you're having a dialogue with, although it's never neutral because it depends on the data set that it's using. And also some of the stuff it says is made up. But somehow plausible. So I find that, you know, I think that's creatively intriguing. So I am actually writing a book at the moment, which has the working title Design in 2040. And I have, in this initial phase of the research for the book, got a ChatGPT to say what design in 2040 might look like. So just to see what it thinks, right? And then I envisage doing more of that along the way. But then to use that in the book, to sort of have a discussion about even doing this, like how do we even talk about the future anyway, which is one of the things the book's exploring sort of methodologically. So I see it as already, well, it's here, so I'm gonna, in a light way, play with it. But it's playing. See, I'm using that word playing. I'm sort of able to, but in 10 years it might not be possible. It might be that it's so built into all sorts of things, you know, devices we use.
They'll be playing with you. I'm just gonna go play with my human.
that's funny. So yeah, it's playing with me. Yeah. And then like, so I went to this conference last year in Dubai, and there was a woman from South Korea, I think she's a professor, and she has been living with a robot for quite a long time. So a sort of humanoid type robot.
Oh, wow.
And so she was talking about that, and it was
like
just
Ex Machina.
Yeah, it was so odd. And And there was so many questions about the robot, like why has the robot sort of got this sort of female appearance, like why does it have to be gendered in that way? And there was just so many questions, and then this sort of service relationship, it's female anyway. And then they were talking about how the use of these, those kind of humanoid robots, possibly already now in care home settings. So I was going, what, you know, and my mother's in a care home, she has Alzheimer's, and so I'm regularly in a care home, and quite familiar with the work that's required to provide care and look after people who are vulnerable. And I was slightly appalled, but then someone else at this conference, that, you know, said, well, you know, but if there's a staff shortage or people aren't available to do that work, and the elderly population and the lack of young people as a then this is a solution, and so they can do these boring routine tasks, the machines that people might not like. And I was still slightly horrified, and this is already a sort of business proposition. So I think that's my current, you know, I'm slightly, so I said playing, and playing with us, but it's also already here in lots of distributed ways. And I think also not necessarily visible, you know, it's when you book a train ticket or you buy something or you get a recommendation in, you know, from something, it's already there influencing you based on whatever, you know, bias and power relations are built into it and whatever data set it has. We may not even be aware of those things, and so the governance of that is problematic, because it's basically, as far as I understand it, in the hands of a very small number of companies, a very few, very large, very powerful tech firms, which probably have all sorts of well-meaning engineers and executives in them. They are controlling how things develop, not, you know, publicly elected democratic governments, because it's partly the speed of change and maybe lack of competence as well amongst officials to understand some of these things. So
yeah.
So overall, yeah, it does worry me, and I'm glad that there's people working on it. I mean, there's a whole load of interesting activists and social researchers, sociologists looking at it. But they're just, you know, probably a drop in the ocean compared to the
Google,
the worm, the sandworm building. Should we go see the sandworm building?
Yeah, let's go. Yeah, and so all university professors in future, are they going to be just AI lecturers?
Well, yeah. So I did actually go to a talk recently, but where somebody did the first minute of the talk. An AI had made him his talk, because he's done quite a lot of talks, so there's video of him, and basically he got it to do his talk.
Wow.
Yeah.
The first minute only.
Yeah, I think maybe it's a minute or two. So okay. Just saying, hello, I'm so and so, and you know, I'm gonna talk about blah blah, and it was plausible, right?
I actually have an idea. Why don't we put this talk into some language learning model and just go and have some cake? And just let the rest of the episode.
Yeah, exactly.
As AI develops, cake prices start to go up.
Thanks for listening to our latest episode of Mindful Conversations. Join me and Shamash in the next episode as we explore with a new guest the potential impact of AI on the future human story. It's been a thought-provoking journey for us, and hopefully it will challenge your perceptions and also spark curiosity. If you liked what you heard, then please leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform, subscribe, share this with someone who you think would enjoy the show, and if you have any questions for us or comments, email us at connect@mindfulcombo.com. Bye for now.